feel like that's something I owe to you people. I know when I was a little kid coming up that, you know, if there was any difference between me and the other kids, it was maybe that I spent more time for myself, more time out in the woods, you know, very much into Indians and, you know, building things, huts, tree huts, underground huts, you know. Whatever, I'd go along for a while and then do that. I remember we got into smoking tobacco back then. You know, I saw winter coming on one year and I said, well, hey, pretty soon we're not going to have any roads back to smoke. So I got a bunch of other kids and went out in the field and picked up just a big pile of red tobacco and put it in this quart inside fruit jars and we were going to save it, you know. And that's, so I think that was a little bit of my addictive thinking, you know, back then. Because, you know, I never even spoke that much red tobacco at the time, but it was kind of the way I thought. And, of course, all the jars went moldy in about a week. But I had thrown them away. But, and later on, I remember coming up with my first drug of choice, which was homebrew, which I would make myself by buying raisins and sugar and water and fermenting them. And, you know, just, I'd get a pretty potent brew out of it. You know, I'd leave it on the windowsill. In the summertime, raisins would float, you know, within a few hours, and within about a week, the solution had gone from cloudy to clear, and then you could drink the stuff. You know, they wasn't all that good, but wasn't all that bad either. And, you know, I feel also that whether it was my parents' fault or my fault, if you want to call it fault, that there were things I didn't learn when I was a baby or a kid or a young person coming up. And these things caused me to fail as I got older and as I got, you know, more and more involved in the world. How do you get that? And, I was the, mama's mama committed suicide, my daddy's daddy committed suicide. So, they may have failed to learn things themselves when they were coming up, and therefore been unable to teach those things to me. Plus, I think I was a pretty wild kid, and I would, you know, get gone, you know, maybe at the times where they would have helped me, would have taught me stuff. You know, it seemed like I was always way ahead of them somehow. I'd get out there, about sex, you know, by the time we got around to telling me about sex, I could quote marriage manuals. And, you know, they'd learn a good bit, you know, just for kids. And, got involved with a 5-year-old group rope one time, for example. But whatever it was, you know, whether I was too busy to listen, too honored to listen, or whether they just didn't have it to teach me, there were a lot of things, there are still a lot of things I don't know about living. And I believe firmly that these things caused me to fail. And the older I got, you know, the more out of the world I got, the more I had to fail, you know, because there were just pieces missing, you know, like I think the car or something, you know, I had a carburetor missing, or spark plugs missing, or something missing, you know. And failure, you know, on one hand, the failure created pain in my life, and on the other hand, it made me really curious about what was going on in the world. And the curiosity, you know, I remember taking a real studied look at my school teachers. You know, what, not only, you know, like apart from whatever subject they were teaching, but, you know, what did they really have going in their life? You know, what, did they have peace of mind or any of that? And I didn't have words for these things, but I know now those are the things I was looking for. And I went to church and got saved. And the people there felt real let down because I didn't think they had any real peace of mind or wisdom that I could perceive. And I guess it was in my mid-teens, I'm a native to Atlanta, and the coffee houses got started, the beefies got started downtown. I remember real clearly reading this, you know, article in the newspaper and seeing on 11 o'clock news, you know, beatniks busted 6 and a half across Peach Creek. And me and Buddy went down there and met them. And started going to their parties and stuff, at least I did. And in those days, I was 16, and in those days, or 15, they wouldn't even let me come to the parties. Well, maybe I wasn't even 15, maybe I was 14. They wouldn't even let me come to the parties because they could get arrested if I had a minor just in the room. You know, regardless of whether they had any beer or dope or whatnot, it was just considered contributing to the delinquency of the minor for beatniks to have any kids present at all. And I was a kid. And about this time, about when I was 13, was the first time I left home. And for a 13-year-old, I think I gave them pretty good shots, you know. Planned it a week ahead of time. I climbed out the window and went over to my friend's house and got him out. He said, we could leave right now if we wanted to. He said, yeah, we could. So a week later we did, and we had sleeping bags and a tarpaulin and a tent and a .22 rifle and some shells and some cook gear and Boy Scout equipment and all that. And we were gonna, and our plan was to go to, from Atlanta to South Florida and to live out in the, either the Okanoke Swamp or the Everglades and hunt and bring in animal skins and trade them for food and money and bullets until we were old enough to work. And, you know, we picked a bad time to go because it was 10 degrees out there. And we were on this little all-state motor scooter, two of us with all that gear. And I mean, you know, we had things like we'd go about 2 or 3 miles and our feet would freeze and we'd have to stop and run around in big circles in the highway. I can remember that clear as a bell. And get our circulation back and we'd go another 10 miles then, stop and run around in a circle and get the circulation back. And I remember a damn t-shirt slipped down that motor scooter and started burning. And we thought the whole motor scooter was burning up. We pulled the t-shirt out and threw it away and kept going. Anyway, that was the first time, and I left home 9 more times. And the distance between me and my parents grew. I guess that's another reason, you know, I didn't learn any more from them, you know, that Jesus must have failed, or, you know, for them to fail. Was because, you know, I was, well, the way I had it in my mind, I mean, it was, in those days, we were kind of brainwashed that as soon as you got away from home, you were able to be yourself. And you get married, and that was what it was all about, you know. And it just looked to us at that time, it seemed like all the adults were very confused and worried people and real busy about money. You know, things didn't seem very important to us, and the, you know, the only way out, it seemed, was to leave home, so we left home a lot, I did. And then, I did some dope with the beatniks, not very much, because it was, they were very, they disapproved of me drinking. I mean, even when I was old, you know, 16, 17. And, you know, but hell, they would do decks of greens and have two cases of beer on Friday and 100 decks of greens and I would consume them by Sunday. You know, one guy did that much almost by himself. And it was a real interesting group. One was a newspaper editor, one was a teacher, high school teacher, one was, you know, had several professional musicians, writers, painters, you know, what have you. And there was about 15 or 20 of us down there. Anyway, the time I left home and stayed gone, I moved into this place downtown called the Baltimore Block. And I lived there with all these friends I'd been carousing with for years. I knew them pretty well, and they knew me. And I would paint signs and support myself that way. And we would have these all-night parties and stuff, and talk about everything in the sun. And a speed freak in New York named Lon Garcia came down, and you know, after, I guess I'd been down there for about 9 months, and I was about 18 years old, and there's this excitement around the block, you know, the Baltimore block. There's a bunch of row houses, old-style houses, like the Spirit North, like Archie Bunker Pine houses. And I said, well, what's this stuff? And he says, well, it's peyote, it's cactus from, you know, southwestern United States, Mexico. I said, what does it do? He says, oh, you see things. And and various things. And so we all sat down and ate this peyote stuff. And it has a natural regurgitant in it, you know, which I guess keeps animals from eating it or something. But you have to be, you have to have a lot of control to then get that stuff down, you know, spitting it up. And I remember we pulled the leaves off, I mean, a little fuzz, we pulled the bark off, cut it up, and, you know, just somehow just take big pieces and swallow them as quick as you can without rule. And I remember sitting down there, and it had been kind of a weird day anyway. You know, there have been certain times in my life when I felt that spiritually things were like coming to a head, and it had been that kind of day. I'd been hitchhiking a little, and I'd gotten some peculiar rides, and I'd have wound up walking the last 15 blocks to home there. And there was this kind of golden radiance in the air. This was before I did any dope at all. And I had this feeling like it was back in the last century. And you know, all these questions have been boiling around in my head, and all these fairly well-educated, you know, college-type people in close association down there just having, you know, brainstorming sessions, you know, just every night for 9 months. And so 2 hours after we ate peyote, we ate it about 4 o'clock, about six, I was just saying, look, this stuff don't work. I mean, you know, Lon must have been lying, man. God damn it, we've fallen for it. We've eaten this stuff and we kept them pouring out for 2 hours and ain't nothing gonna happen, man. And we got to laughing about it. And then suddenly we were high. And I have to say that was probably, you know, one of the most marked experiences in my life. You know, the only equivalent things, you know, the miracle of this program. And we did a lot of running around and a lot of talking and a lot of exploring dark alleyways and looking out windows at lights and talking to one another and laying around and meeting pals of people and looking at alphabet soup on the ceiling, it looked like. And I remember one thing that was kind of important to me later on was I remember pulling away from this guy that was trying to show me something. And old Speed Freak Ron Garcia told me something that's, you know, meant a little bit to me, you know, even now. And he says, you ought to go back there and see what that fella has to show you. He says, even if it's not worth seeing. And I said, well, why? That doesn't make sense. I'm busy, man. I got, you know, I'm going to put you over so-and-so. He says, just go ahead and do it and see how it works out. So I rolled my eyes and heaved my chest, and I went around and said, okay, what was it? And he says, look at this street lamp down the alleyway there. Look. And I looked down there, and sure enough, that was the world's greatest street lamp. I mean, it was just like, you know, beautiful painting or something like that. It was just, you know, like real super 3D, and the colors were just magnificent. You know, the night was full of stuff like that. But I remember that little bit of sharing, you know, not so much from the drug point of view, but just from the opening up, you know, to what another might have to offer. And so then everything else was, you know, it lasted through the next day. And the only other significant thing out of that first trip was that I remember looking at the morning sun and saying, I don't need to do no more drugs. There ain't nothing else drugs is going to tell me. You know, I done took it as far as it's going to go with drugs tonight. And I guess the only reason I did more drugs is because I didn't have anything better to do, you know. And it's just patently impossible to get addicted to peyote, but I mean, I kept doing peyote. And a lot of other strange things happened, and I wound up down in South Florida for about 9 months. And I lived down there in Coconut Grove, and I went to all the coffee houses in town, and I lived with all the people that went to the coffee houses, and there was about 90 or 100 of us. And the group was composed of everybody from bums like I was, I don't know what I was doing exactly. You know, technically, in my mind, I was on the road. You know, I'd been, we'd got Kerouac. And so I remember this one horrible moment. It was very depressing when I was taking a shower down there and thinking, is this all there is? Is this what I'm going to be doing the rest of my life? You know? And, because, you know, like anybody, I felt like my life was precious to me. I wanted to be doing something, but I didn't know what. But it was really a frightening moment. And I don't know any better way to describe it, and maybe the people who had moments like that will know what I'm talking about. I hope the rest of you don't, ever. But anyway, I came just about immediately back up to Atlanta and got married for the first time. Got into night school and finished that, got into college, finished the first marriage, went into the second marriage, did a lot more dope right after that first marriage, and at the beginning of the second marriage. And by this time, my disease, my addiction had progressed. I wasn't, you know, just doing anything. I wasn't doing peyote ever. But I was doing fairly huge quantities of weed and hashish and my first LSD, which is sugar juice from New York. And some speed, you know, heavy and light. No, I hadn't shot dope yet. And I was about 20. And my second wife had this really crazy thing, man. She would just freak out if I drank even one little sip of the beer. You know? And she told me that her daddy had died from alcoholism, and I couldn't see what that made any difference than drinking beer. But, you know, maybe that's what that marriage lasted a pretty good while, about 2 years. And, you know, in the old days, that was all about me. And we didn't have any children by the first marriage, and we didn't have anybody by the second either. And, let's see. So anyway, that during that marriage, I didn't drink much. I mainly went to college and worked. And we had a pretty good time, she and I. And then, at the end of that marriage, she had one, you know, real flaw, which was jealousy. I mean, she was super jealous. And she would make up things to be jealous about. I wrote my aunt's phone number down in one of my books from college. She called it up, checking out the numbers, you know. My aunt has the phone. She got embarrassed and hung up. But, you know, that's one thing about Bo, man, especially back in the old days when I was using, you know, don't dare me, because I'll do it. So I finally did, and that was the end of the marriage. And I did a lot more dope. And I moved out to Buckhead, and I started getting into a little bit of dealing grass, and I was still going to college. And I was raising orchids. And welcome, you people. So, talk about the failure. I mean, this time, the only real failure I'd had in my life mainly was having failed a year in high school. You know, I failed the 11th year, and I was repeating it when I dropped out and looking for the last time on the road and all that. Then I came back and went back to high school, and eventually got into Georgia State College. And that was my main failure up to that point. I remember keeping the mental record. I remember this same feeling that it even felt a little bit the same at the time, that I could afford to pull all the shit, because then I would do some good things and then kind of compensate for them and even it up, you know. And sooner or later I'd raise hell, you know, what you might call a binge nowadays. I was just having fun what I thought was doing. And you know, and I'd fuck up a good bit, whatever how much I thought I could get away with, and then I'd straighten up and get all squared up. And I tried to keep it, you know, balanced where, you know, I wouldn't fail too much. And then going to college, working for about 2 years, 2.5, 3 years there, I was doing things like taking diet pills to stay awake because I got into them from studying for exams, and getting 5 hours sleep a night at 4.5, and telling people how neat it was, you know, it was, you know, really, why waste the extra 3.5 hours? There was an article out that, you know, all the human body really required for rest was 3.5 to 4 hours, 4.5 hours. well, why waste the rest of the time? What I was really doing was I was burning myself out. And, you know, and the stacks of school books I had to buy every quarter got bigger. And the demands for study time and all that put on me were greater. It just got harder and harder to keep up, and I did more and more dope. And somehow I thought the more dope was going to help me, but I know it hurt me, you know. And finally, one day this woman comes skittering down the street, the side swipes me head on the side of the car, and broke one arm and put the other arm in a brace for about 6 weeks. And that knocked me out of college. I tried to go back, and I was too squirrely and too dope tight. I was like 2 months behind of whatever they had been studying. And it was just like being in a dream, a bad dream. And I left. That was the last time I was in there. And so then I really got into dealing a lot. And that was 68. And you know, in 69, I think I went up to some of the big peace marches, and I got more and more dope, and I had a really special girlfriend named Susan that later died of heroin overdose out in California, and we had, you know, parties at the house all the time, and, you know, we dealt a lot of dope, and crazy things would happen, you know, the cops would come in and he would say, yes, can I help you? And reach over and quietly put marijuana under the table and scrape the leaves off. And say, yes, sir, right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right in front of them. And somehow we didn't get busted. And, you know, and I got, you know, doing some speed and, you know, just that bit form. And then through a peculiar circumstance of event, we had a big issue at our house about, you know, we didn't know anybody that knew anybody that dealt hard drugs, is what we call them, more drugs, which was heroin and speed, you know, heavy speed. And so this roommate of mine was placed in a situation where he might have to go to jail. And so this other guy had been given a dime bag of speed, and Herschel didn't have to go to jail, so we still had that, and we got paranoid one night, so we hid it. Well, where do you think we hid it? We dissolved it in water and hid it in the bottom of an empty whiskey bottle. You know, isn't that a great hiding place? And he thought it was. So come Sunday, nobody tripped with me, and I said, well, if I'm going to trip by myself, might as well make a good one. So I downed that entire dime bag of crystal. And then I was out talking to Blue Street for about 5 days. I would follow those poor suckers around the house, talking their heads off all day long, and then finally pass out. I would go in there and lay on my bed, strum my guitar all 3 or 4 hours. And then whichever the first one that passed out was, they'd wake up and I'd hear him scurrying around. And I'd go in there and say, oh, you awake yet? And he'd say, oh no, oh no.
Yeah, run.
I remember things happening in that house, like being here, making love to this young girl. And, Herschel says, she was mumbling something, I was laying in her arms, she was mumbling something about, you know, her mother might be looking for. And Herschel says, my God, Bill, I think it's her mother outside. She's in love with her. And I says, oh no. And, you know, we got time to finish. That was a moment of concern. And so back up, here comes the mama in the front door. We're in the bedroom. There's a little hallway that opens in several rooms. And we're one of the rooms with the door wide open. And it's totally dark in the room, totally lit in the hallway. And it's the bulb, you know, like doesn't throw light into the room. Her mother might be looking for, and hers was this, "My God, Bill, I think it's your mother outside." She's in the other room. And I says, "Oh no." And, you know, we got time to finish that with mom, sorry. And so back God, here comes the mama in the front door. We're in the bedroom with a little hallway that opens in several rooms, and we're one of the rooms with the door wide open. Totally dark in the room, totally lit in the hallway. And it's the bulb, you know, like doesn't throw light into the room. And so she comes bounding into the house, right into that center hallway with the light there. And we're in the dark room. And we quietly stand up, and we're standing there naked looking at each other and looking at the mother. And she can't see us because she's like 5 feet away in this other room. It's lit. I mean, it's just, what are you going to do, you know? And Herschel gets her, and he's a great book salesman, he's very good with his tongue. And he says, "Oh, come right over here, Mrs. So-and-so, look here." And she says, "What are you cutting the lights off for? Here." And she cut one on, and he come right to her. "Oh, we like the lights off. It, you know, it makes it very restful on the eyes and stuff." And so she'd just keep going around the room cutting them on. He'd go around cutting them off. And, God, we slipped in this other little dead-end room on the back of the house, and what do you weigh out? And besides, the cops were out in the yard, you know, we had the place around it. And somehow Herschel talked me out of that one. He got very gracious for it. But we really did a lot more dope, and you might say our mutual evictions for rest. Because one night I come home, and you know, we were at this stage, we would do things like as a group, we would go down to see 2001 and sit on the front row, and all the dope fiends sat on the front row, not the second, not the third, the front row. It would be 50 of us, and then totally empty seats, and then the audience back there, and I suppose they'd spend half the time watching us and half the time watching me, because right, especially at the end, we would always do Amy Mindtree. I mean, you know, I went to see that movie 7 or 8 times. And, you know, for one time it would be like one Amy among 3 or 4 people. And then we would buy boxes, pass them up and down the road. And then we would be like doing 2 in each nostril, you know, where you didn't have to hold them up there. And looking at those lights and things, and literally falling around on the floor. I don't see how we didn't get busted. Because, I mean, it had to be conspicuous. And saying, "Too fucking fudge! Too fucking fudge!" Rolling around. And, you know, and like, as our disease progressed there, you know, one night I come home and I go stepping into my dark bedroom, and there's this just as dense popcorn clatter under my feet. And I says, "Herschel, what is this shit on my floor?" No answer. And I know he's awake in the other room. And there should have been an answer. I say, "Herschel, what is this shit on the floor?" Says, "I put it there." I says, "I know, but what you supposed to do? It looks like birdseed, isn't it?" He says, "Yes. And I said, "Well, what in the goddamn hell is it? It's even up under my damn bed. What is it doing? What's it?" And he says, "I was worried the cops were going to die. You know, you're pretty sloppy, dope man. And I put it in there in case there might be some seeds on the floor." He had spread about 50 pounds of birdseed everywhere, under the closet, under the entire bed. And I mean, it was even. Somehow he had gotten it even. Under the dresser, under the table, under the chairs, the whole floor is even with birdseed. Now, I know that if any policeman had tried to bust us that night, we'd come in there and say, "Ah, oh, this room's obviously clear. Nothing but birdseed." And I knew that the guy had to be so whacked out that I didn't need to comment on that. I said, if he's that weird, I ain't going to talk to him now. I talked to him a little bit the next day. Gotta get crazy. And, you know, I remember, you know, like when I moved into that place, they had this, like, the greenhouse, 12 to 24 foot greenhouse, and it had some, about a $2,000 orchid collection, and I had, you know, a lot of friends, good girlfriend. I had a motorcycle that would go 140 miles an hour, and I never found the road for it. And I had a car, had a job, and going to college. And, but you might say some things going for me. And at the end, I didn't have the orchids at all. I'd given them away in desperation. You know, I sold them $50 to Dr. Wells, who was the head of the computer center down at Georgia State. And the motorcycle I got rid of because I couldn't afford the payments on it. I ran the girlfriend off because I was getting so hard to live with. And I got so crazy that I would search my friends and they would come by there. I wouldn't let them come in and get dope. I said, I don't give me that shit. Go out there and put in the fucking bushes. You remember where it was. You know, you can't come in here, you know, if you got any dope on you. And they accepted it, you know. I made it very presentable to them. They just went out and hid the dope. And I'd have people coming in, maybe trying to bust me. I don't know. They would say, so-and-so sent me down here. And I would say, and I trained the guy, and I said, the first thing I would say is, don't you never send nobody here for no dope, man, unless you be with them. Because if they come, and, you're not with them, you're feeling like nuts. And so I just, you know, this guy came out and I said, I want to, you know, spend about $5,000 or $6,000 in business. I says, who are you? How did you get my money? You know, what makes you think I can help you with this? He says, oh, Gary sent me down. And I says, oh, is that right? And so I had another fairly big dealer in the room with me. So I introduced him by his full, correct first name and everything. And he got real heated about that the next day. But I was saying, I was telling you between the lines, you shut the fuck up. Don't talk to this guy. And I says, and I've got to go to sleep. Well, good night. And I just left the room and went on to sleep. The guy just left, you know. And, you know, but we were real thorough going about not avoiding bus and stuff like that. Then one night we had $600 worth of dope ripped off, and we were very upset because we knew we wouldn't be able to explain it to this guy. My partner John thought he knew who had gotten it, so we got him over there and smoked a joint. And was talking wrong, and I said, let's take him, John. And the guy looked pretty nervous and started to laugh, you know. So we just very methodical. I took the head. I had my arm cast still from that motorcycle wreck. And John took his feet, and he thrashed around quite a bit. And I went to hit him one time, hit the wall, and broke my hand. But I got him on the next shot, so he fired it down a bit. And we hauled him downstairs with this big rope and a knife. We got the rope into him. He got nervous about the knife. So we didn't tell him the knife was the rope anymore. We wanted him nervous. And we went out to look for his buddy. And then we was going to get it out of where the rope was. And so between one thing and another, we just finally let the guy go and go to sleep. And the next day I woke up and I said, damn, was that me? Was that some kind of damn movie, you know? And I said, where's the peace of love, you know? And I'm getting out of dealing. And so I told all my dealer buddies that I'm getting out, and this is it. I don't want to hear nothing about nothing. I know what's coming in and who's coming in with. Don't talk to me about it because I'm going to quit dealing. 3 weeks, you know, November, 68, I guess it was. And, you know, and I ain't going to have to call me a month. I figured 3 weeks was long enough. And So every time they start talking about some gold nation coming in town or anything, I just said, shut up, I don't want to hear it. I even held a party at the end of the 3 weeks and invited all of my connections. And I introduced them to each other in the same fucking room, and that was a gas. Because they liked to run and hide and be sneaky, man. And here they were at the cold light of day saying hi to one another. You know? And it was so they wouldn't call me a narcissist. And so they got nervous and just went into separate rooms and made their connections, and that was that. You know? And I had gotten somewhat crazy by this time. And I tried to deal speed for a while. And all I wound up doing was shooting a lot of samples up. And I got really crazy behind some crystal. And I mean, I didn't have anything to do. I would do things like take 12 Rolling Stone albums and put them on a turntable that would carry that many, and they would play each one all the way through and drop down the next one, the next one, the next one. They'd sit there in a vibrating chair with headphones on and listen to them, each and every one, with my eyes closed. And I remember thinking, you know, what if somebody comes into this room and touches me? you know, go into orbit. And I probably would have. Because, you know, it's a weird place. I was seeing ghosts coming down the hall and stuff like that. And I would close my eyes and be dreaming, and I would go into these electric trances. And I'd feel like, you know, my whole body was coursing with electric energy, and I could hear little popping sounds up in my brains. And it was very crazy times. And I remember I'd be in one room and I'd go to sleep. And I would hear the noise like an animal the size of a possum with maybe 3-inch nails running around the walls of the room in the next room. And I'd say, it can't be happening, you know. Can't be happening. And, you know, and I even called up some friends from the Theosophical Society and had them come down and exercise the place. And really, that stopped the ghost and poltergeists. And let's see, it didn't stop me from shooting ghosts. And I was getting so crazy then that I remember this one lovely little girlfriend of mine come down and took her clothes off and crawled in bed with her. And I just, you know, I was tripping or something, though. Didn't even care enough about sex. You know, she was saying something to me. And, you know, and I would just burn out and float. That's all it was. And I think I lasted a couple more months, you know, abusing. And finally the crystal ran out. And it just got to be cold hell to be over it all. It had been so much fun. It had been so great, so lovely. You know, 80 shots of blue morphine at that time. And I thought, yeah, that's exactly what I thought it would be. You know, it just kind of made me drunk. A girl fixed me with the left of the toilet paper roll and tied off the chain necklace I had. Did it and just, you know, that just, I just went into down because it was uppers. I was sending stuff very uppers. I mean, I would like shoot 7 calves, you know, and go throw a newspaper route. And, so, anyway, it just, you know, make a long story short, I finally asked myself a big question, could it be the dope, you know, and it was, and, you know, and I was really depressed about it, because I had really made quite the best in this thing, I mean, you know, like, lifestyle, like, I remember it was very strange when I would run into people that were like office workers or business people. They even listened to things they were talking about were just kind of dumb and like they were play acting some goddamn soap opera on the TV. I couldn't believe it. They were so asinine and vain and pointless. And just, you know, really just kind of gave me the creeps being around, you know, straight people. And And here I was to the point where I couldn't do that. boy, that ain't a dilemma, what is? But I was real mad at what Doak had done to me. I was real mad and hurt about my girlfriend down in California. And I was getting out of some of the, I figured my withdrawal lasted maybe 5 or 6 years. It was only the last couple of years that it didn't even like good or have a normal. So like my next move didn't have to be thoroughly calculated and thought out well in advance, designing for flowers and it thought out. When I quit using, I had Pam trip across the room to see if I could get anything. And it was drastic. It was like reverse Charlie, the movie Charlie where he gets an operation from Super Smart. I don't know if I was ever super smart, but I was smart enough. And then I became super fucking dumb. About 2 years. And it was terrible. It was so long too that I forgot about, being any other way. And this song said it was my best friend for the rest of my life. And I never expected it was much better at all. But anyway, I couldn't do no more dope. I got involved with it. And I had some insane things come, like we had a party one night, somebody got some damn asses and punch, but I didn't really get off on it. Certainly didn't go for it. And another time somebody literally came up on the street and clapped the hem of my mouth to the joint of the thing. And I like that. And that fucked me up so goddamn bad. And I was kissing the street, stomped around, had walked around for an hour, come down enough to go where I was going. So I was fucking mad. But they didn't, I didn't get high no more. I just got fucked up. Boy, I can sure drink. That's what I'm saying, of course. But, the folks, it wasn't no damn willpower got me. I just couldn't have it. And I was embarrassed it couldn't have to get away, but I was also very much touching the fact that I couldn't have it. I guess taking my first step back then, I had no notion of programming anything. And finally, it got the 5,000 in the hole, which is about all the other people in the hole. Had to go and shut down, and I went away and started painting signs, and I had gotten married one more time when I was down to the there, so then after I got away, there was a few more of them big peace marches, and I got dressed, and a lot of fun. That goes there was very nice. There's two cops, there's two lawyers there, the cops in jail. They're on our side. I pretty much gave up in the notion of having any kind of successful life, any kind of real happy. I've had at least contacts with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've even gone so far as finding an NA pamphlet holding about 4 meetings. This is like 1972, 1973. But I didn't know enough. I'd gone to I didn't know enough about the program to be of any help to anything, so those meetings seemed boldy, and I just went away. Now I'm about here, and finally that fourth marriage, I call my credit card marriage, because my credit ran out, so he was a wife. And it was
things, because none of these marriages, none of these girlfriends, I mean, boys, we make love a lot, but we never had no kids. And so I was sitting down there just depressed and lonely, and I've been working down crossword puzzles and onions and you know, eating steaks and drinking beer and drinking coffee at 11 o'clock. I wake up and eat some dinner, you know, so I can watch the news and the late show, especially, and then I drink some more beer so I can relax and go to sleep, you know. So I was just drinking, you know, just fucking existing. I was just so bored. I didn't want to go get laid. I didn't want to go see anybody. I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to go any damn movies. And I was just real pissed off, you know, about living myself and everything. So one night, it just got so bad that I went to an AA meeting, you know. And I figured I'd see some friends there, and I did. And I just thought they was okay, and I liked the coffee and company. I went around, and I don't think I went back the second night. I know I didn't get a white shirt the first night. And I thought, you know, after... I came every few days that first week or something, and then I didn't drink anymore after the first Saturday night, though. And pretty soon I was going to meetings every day, sometimes two or three times a day. And because, you know, I'm an addicted person, and when I like something, I really like it. And I really like this because this is the first good news I've heard in years that I might have a disease. I just figured I was just generally messed up. Messed up person, I had no hope. That's what they talk about. Just depressing. Talking about anything else. And I heard about this idea that you know, that people that seemed very much like me had a disease, a alcoholism. That kept them from being the people they wanted to be. And good people come to your program and you could find out how to treat your illness. And find out from the people that came before what they did to help them, that helped me. And that's the best deal I've had in years. Probably that was the only good deal possible for me. And I just got, you know, totally enamored with the program. I just started going to meetings everywhere. I went in little meeting groups. And down at the end of the day, and I just stalk into a meeting, and as I always say, drug out when they go through, I'm asking him to be free to do anything. Because I wasn't an alcoholic in my mind, even though I stopped drinking and came in. And I held on to that white shit, you know, put him back to drink. And after 5 months, I heard my story. I told the local clubhouse on here, and I identified the guy, and I've since been led the alcohol and drug, you know, that addiction. But I knew from the beginning that I had been a drug addict and I was that type of person and stuff. So when I heard about them having the NA meeting, I, you know, slipped in on that one. Did not want to go, but stayed. And kept coming back for more, and that was the time that I did was tiny and resist now. It's 4, 5, 6 weeks sometimes. And it just kept growing and growing and growing. Now that we, you know, we have over 50 people every week. And that 10 times of 9. And it's really giving me a new home. You know? And I got married since I've been in the program. I got the first child since I've been in the program. 30 years. 30 years. And this is like my first marriage. Because it's the first one that, you know, had any children. And in terms of folks, you know, when people are married, they don't have children, they just go back to their sex families. And so I'm real grateful for that. And I got into really closely examining the program when I came in, and I found out the principle of surrender to them, that it's okay for me to say I can't do something, because it doesn't mean I can't do anything, they just mean I can't do this and this and this, and if I keep trying to do them, I'm going to keep failing and keep experiencing pain. And the real name of the game is just don't try something, if you think you're going to fail at it, just don't do it. When you ask what to do something that you can do, or do nothing at all. Wait till you want to do something. And that may sound a little, that sounded a little chicken to me, that's what I thought, you know. Hell, he just may not be yellow liver, you know. But, you know, which you probably are, but, you know, being sporosis and stuff. I've been educated to the point of view, that just makes simple good sense. And that's where a winner comes from. The winner is the person that don't lose. And the person that don't lose, don't go into losing setups. And I like to have at least 90% odds in my favor before I go into something. And, you know, I really got in touch with the disease out here and all that. And, they asked me to come to believe in the power greater than myself. And I've been into God for a long time. You know, I've just been into Hinduism, Taoism, Shinto, Buddhism, Mohammedanism, Judaism, Christianity. There just wasn't much I hadn't been into, you know. And they asked me to come to believe in the power greater than myself. And I thought, well, I've believed for a long time. And as far as basic belief goes, that may be true, but I did not have a conscious contact with the power greater than myself. I didn't have any idea that you could pray as much as I pray now and get results with it. I didn't know. I don't know, it's just weird. I think something magic about the program puts you in a place where some of the things you used to think you know suddenly become useful to you. You know, whereas I know they're useful. In all sorts of ways for the program. I really tried to open my mind from the point where I came to the program and get some new ideas about the higher power and how it works for other people. And this helped me get not only more peace with God as I understood him when I came in, but have a new understanding of God too.
Oh, yeah, I worked the steps. And that was the worst thing. And
kind of the point where I was willing, you know, to change all of my life and all of my will. And I'm considering, like, what would happen if I did that? You know, would I go pop like a bubble, soap bubble, you know? Or would a thunderbolt come out of the sky? Or would I have to move to another city or change my name, you know? Or, you know, what would happen if I did that? What am I holding back? What are my reservations? How can I get rid of it? And just reaching the point where I felt and still feel that I can't afford any reservations. The greatest venture in life for human beings is to swim in this river called God. And go with the whole thing. If you hold back anything, it's just shit, it's just nothing. It ruins you. And if you let go absolutely, nothing happens except you become part of God. And you lose your fear. And many things become possible that are otherwise impossible. And a person who has done that reaches, I believe, in my case, a state of mind where a defective touch is something that kept me from doing God's will as I understood it or as I felt it, would be like putting a bug in the middle of a fine dinner. You know, it just don't belong there anymore. You know?